Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Business Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Boleyn. Today on this show, we're talking with George Howard, who is the Associate Professor of Management at Berklee College of Music and Head of Music at Music Audience Exchange. We're going to talk to Howard about music discovery and curation. A few months ago, he wrote an essay in Forbes where he essentially said that music discovery is not a problem and that startups that are pursuing it are wasting their time. We're going to dig into all of that and more. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Business Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. And if you like the show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. Here is our interview with George Howard. As I said at the top of the show, we are joined by George Howard. Say hello, George.
Hi, I'm George.
Recently, you wrote a piece on Forbes called Why Music Services Are Wasting Time Recommending New Music. You argue that people might tell companies like Pandora and Spotify that they want to discover new music, but this isn't actually what they want. Did any recent event or conversation inspire this piece? Why did you write this essay?
It's certainly drawn from very, very practical and real world experience. You know, for many years, I worked with first as sort of a consultant and then as the COO of the parent company for Daytrotter and Concert Vault. And so I was able to see people's habits. And I was also able to just sort of see it anecdotally in terms of the way people interact with music. And this isn't, I was shocked at the sort of, you know, noise that this generated from writing this piece, because I didn't think that this would be news to anyone, right? I mean, all you have to do is look at traditional terrestrial radio and how they operate. And you understand that people don't want not just new music, people just don't want new shit generally, right? I mean, nobody wants anything new. They want exactly what they have and what they've always had when it comes to music or anything else. Anytime Facebook makes a change to their interface, you'd think that, you know, the world was going to end. So customers don't ever want anything new. And so it just started as I say, looking at the data from the companies that I was running and say, you know what, why can't we sort of figure out how to, why aren't people doing more quote unquote exploring. And then, so you look at the context that's out there with all these idiot, you know, music streaming services out there, and they're all sort of lauding that they do curation or discovery or all this. And it just got me increasingly frustrated, because it's such a classic case of sort of a solution looking for a problem. Right, where all these music streaming companies are so desperate to avoid commoditization, to try to differentiate themselves. And the sad reality, and we're seeing this, you know, writ large with the Jay-Z fiasco, the sad reality is they really don't have anything different to offer anyone. So, you know, places like, in particular, Beats or whatever, was sort of making their competitive advantage, their sort of value proposition of, look, we're going to introduce you to new stuff, or we're going to curate new stuff. And I was like, well, no, you're not. And it's not because you're doing it bad or whatever. It's because people don't want it. And then I sort of turned to other things in which we are ostensibly recommended new stuff, and Netflix being sort of the worst offender. That's just not what people want. Apparently, people want Adam Sandler movies, right? I mean, that's who they're giving production deals to, or that, you know. So this whole idea that the majority of people want something new is preposterous, right? In any sort of distribution of population, you are going to have some small percentage of people, call them mavens, as Malcolm Gladwell does, or influencers, or whomever, that derive some degree of pleasure out of discovering new things. That always has and always will be an incredibly small percentage of people. So it makes no sense to me, as a business person, as a marketing person, that you would put out as your value proposition something that the vast majority of your customers don't care about. And so my piece was not meant to be inflammatory. It was really meant to be instructive. Hey, stop stop trying to sell people stuff they don't want. Instead, look at the things they actually do want and give them more of that, right? That I remember at Rykodisc, like we would occasionally joke, maybe we should put records out that people actually want to buy, right? People seem to want the stuff they already know. And so my line was, you know, go deep rather than wide. If I really like something, then give me more things that are sort of, you know, directly related to that. And then I get off on this sort of tangent, and I think I'm right. But it's like the recommendations that we're getting are so unbelievably bad, and it's because they do sort of one degree of separation or one sort of standard deviation where it's like, oh, George, you like the Rolling Stones. You might also like Creedence Clearwater Revival. Guess what? Yes, I do. I already know about them. That's non-helpful. That's non-value-adding. You know, instead, if I like the Rolling Stones, give me more of the deep stuff. Give me more of the thing. So go deep rather than wide.
Why do you think streaming services spend so much time recommending people new music? Is it because they need people to spend more time on their service listening to more songs in order for those people to get their money's worth out of their listening habits?
No, I think it's a lemming mentality. It's we music service do this thing. We recommend, this started back with Amazon, you know, where if you like this, you know, you might like that, right? And so that's become sort of a tenant of the internet. So music services, and it makes sense, right? I mean, it becomes one of those conventional wisdom things that no one questions, and you just start accreting stuff on top of it, right? It's like, okay, this is an axiomatic thing. We are a music service, therefore we must have a recommendation thing, right? And again, it didn't start with music. It started with Amazon and books or whatever. And sometimes that's sort of nice, and sometimes it sort of works, but I defy anyone to tell me, you know, the last time they bought some book on Amazon and then actually took some action on some recommended book or whatever, that it just doesn't happen. So then they get into this mindset of, okay, others are doing this. We have to do this. Let's expand upon it. Right. I mean, it's that cliche of we've lost our way, so let's redouble our efforts. Right. And that's where it is.
So I'll actually jump in because I do. Occasionally, not often, but occasionally I'll check out recommendations, especially on Amazon for books.
Recommendations or okay, you bought this thing and then others who have bought this, and I actually think that's better. I think I actually look at others who have bought this, but something that Amazon says, you know, you might also like this. Really, how often are you actually making that purchase? I'm not saying it never happens, but...
You know, I think, honestly, it changed when I switched devices because I had a Kindle, just like an Amazon Kindle,
yep.
And that would pop up every time I finished a book. Uh-huh. And often, if I was like on vacation or traveling, that would be very easy for me to just sort of click through and be like, oh, well, they're recommending this book by the same author, or they're recommending a book with a similar... So, sure. You know, I was using it more then. Ever since I switched to using the Kindle app on my iPad, where that doesn't automatically pop up, I've used it less and less because it's not right in front of me.
It's not in your face, yeah. And that's part of it. And that goes to Kyle's point. I mean, you know, if the general business thesis is, look, we need people to come to our service and stay on the service, either, you know, from Pandora's perspective so they'll hear more ads, or for other services so they don't churn, so they don't lose them, then that sort of time on site is a key metric, you know, generally. So if it's okay, I don't know. I don't see that with music so much. It's not the same thing with books. I mean, with books, you've put this sort of time investment into it. That's a very different experience than a 30-second or 3-minute song or what have you.
Well, so I actually want to talk about the last line of your Forbes piece, which is basically where you say these services would be far better served by focusing on delighting their customers by providing more content related to the artists they already love, rather than convincing them to love something new. So, you know, if you can spin that out a little, do you mean new content from the artist? Do you mean side projects?
Sure.
Or do you mean related content in the sense of like films or TV shows?
So
here's the thing. So speaking of Amazon, actually, them not doing a good job at recommendations.
Right.
So I bought the Kim Gordon autobiography,
Girl
right?
In the Band,
great book. So the recommendations they gave me were all books about music, which is fine. Like, yeah, I actually was interested in reading like the book by Viv Albertine.
Oh, yeah. That's a great book. Yeah.
Yeah. Great book as well. Like, it's spot on recommendation.
But wouldn't you have found, weren't you already aware of that book, Courtney? You
know what I mean? Well, and also, they didn't recommend like, buy Sonic Youth Records, buy Side Project.
Right. This is what I mean. You're making a good point.
Buy 1991, the year punk broke.
Like, yeah.
They are so
Chicone Youth or something. It's lame. Yeah,
they're siloed, right?
That, like, that's it. Exactly. Because it's algorithmic. And that's exactly where I get pissed off. It's super algorithmic and super super sort of quote unquote machine learning. And you're dead right. Now, how, and this is where, I mean, the answer to this lies in just what you said, and companies don't want to do it because it's expensive. Like, they want it to be just pure machine learning or whatever. You bought Kim Gordon's Girl in the Band. Well, that's a fairly recent rock biography. Here are some others. What they didn't do, and I don't know if there is a, if there's an algorithm that could have done this, but like, so why not throw you to, as I said, Chicone Youth or Sonic Youth or, you know, in the music or that, you know, or as you said, the year the punk broke documentary or any number of things. I mean, fashion. I mean, there's so many, she is such a hub, right? She is such a hub that so many spokes can come off of, that it's almost embarrassing that they don't do that. And I love that idea of going into sort of different genres, and maybe that's where we get. Maybe, I mean, I think Tidal sort of hinted at that, right? Like, I mean, that videos and stuff would be sort of part of their offering too. But I don't know. Now you've got Google, sort of.
Well, but the other place to sort of spin this out, and this is something that I've written about before, is the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, we all probably have a certain persona that we hew relatively close to, and some of that is based on where we live, what we do for work, what we listen to, what we watch on TV. Like, there are, you know, people are individuals, but they fall into buckets. And the problem with recommendations is they don't ever look at you in the bucket. Like, they look at you as a genre person. They look at you as someone who likes rock or hip hop.
Right,
you're going to like more rock or more hip hop. They're not going to look at you as someone who likes discovering cool new stuff versus, you know, pop stuff versus good workout music. And you know, there are services that kind of get into this area.
Songs. I mean, like, so songs, I think of, it's sort of like Churchill said about free market democracies. It's the best, or what is it? The worst form of government, except for all the rest. And, and songs are sort of like that too. Songs are sort of the worst, except for all the rest, which means it's sort of, you know, like the world's tallest midget or something. And like songs that tries to do it sort of mood based. And I find myself going back to that more than something else, you know? Right.
But there's also the fact that they don't take like a full cultural picture of you. So like, again, another example, I watched, I downloaded some episodes of The Americans to watch on a trip.
Yeah.
And there was one episode of The Americans that had this Fleetwood Mac sync that was incredible. So, and people were writing about it and blogging about it. And I had this on iTunes, right? This wasn't like a pirated thing.
Right.
So I go to iTunes Music. They don't recommend Fleetwood Mac to me. Like, they don't recommend anything to me, you know? And it's just this kind of you have all my data. I give the internet everything, right?
I know, me too. And it gives me nothing back. Okay. No, you're so right. And that's the frustration, right? If we have in fact made this trade-off, which I'm fine with, by the way, right? If we've made this trade-off that everything that I do, not just on the internet, but with my Nest thermostat, with, you know, any of my sort of Internet of Things are collecting data about me, then dear Lord, where's the payoff? Like, where do I actually get that moment of anticipating my desires? And we're just not there, you know. And we're sort of talking about two different things, but yeah, you're right. And so you fall into that category as I do, and I'm sure Kyle does too. Like I want to go super deep when I find something that I love. Like, I get obsessed with it, you know. And Kim Gordon's a great example, right? And so, you know, I would read everything. I would listen to, and they were so influential in terms of turning me on to so many other things, visual art, everything else. I did that pre-internet, right? I mean, in 1985 or whatever, when Sister came out or whatever it was, like you would have to write away to get the Face magazine or whatever, NME, and then scour the articles and then write for other things. And yet we haven't been able to sort of make that jump. Now, the interesting thing to me is that we are a small percentage of people. Like we're freaks. We'll go and we'll do those things. And that makes us really happy. And we do it just because it makes us happy. The vast majority of people under the distribution curve will never, ever, ever do that and look at us like we have three eyes because we do that type of thing. However, we become the ones that then turn those people on to the interesting things. And no music services have really done that very well either. They haven't empowered those sort of, you know, key users to be better broadcasters. And right. I don't get that, you know.
And like I look at, so going back to talking about like the early 90s again, you're right. I mean, I would right away to the Face and I would do the same type of going deep thing. And one of the things that I would do is I would sit and read Rolling Stone, like go to the library and sit and read Rolling Stone. Right. And I remember very clearly reading an interview with Nirvana and Kurt Cobain talks about, I like Bikini Kill. I like the Melvins. I like, right. And so I, sorry, library, I tore that page out of the magazine and I put it in my book bag and I took the bus to the record store and I bought all those records because I 100% trusted that Kurt Cobain knew what he was talking about. And those records changed my life. Exactly. And, you know, you don't get that experience. I mean, yeah, Spotify kind and Tidal kind of do that. Like the Beyonce playlist on Tidal. I mean, I like Beyonce. I listened to that. It was fun. Yeah. But, you know, but those seem a little bit more sort of like, yeah, Beyonce's publicist wrote that. It wasn't Beyonce.
Yeah. And that's it exactly. I mean, and so I think that there's, I don't know. I mean, I wrote this thing when maybe the way you are with R.A.M. and I mean with Nirvana, and I love them too. But I was with R.E.M. and so Peter Buck was like he was my Google or whatever. Like he was my interface to what was cool. And I'm looking at the article that I wrote for Paste when they broke up. I don't know if it's in here or not, but like I made a list like of all the things that that like he influenced me. And it, oh, here it is. So it was like The Byrds, Patti Smith, Jack Kerouac, Margaritas, the beverage, right? Oscar Wilde, Rickenbacker guitars, Faulkner, Television, the band, Howard Finster, the artist, Flannery O'Connor. Like it's exactly what you're saying about Kim Gordon. It's so much deeper than sort of music. Though music is there, that just sort of becomes this touch point. And just as you said, it's become so insanely siloed. And I just think we're doing a bad job of presenting the information that somebody actually might not make this sort of very sloppy intellectual sort of algorithmic thing. Oh, you like R.E.M.? You might also like, you know, whoever, the Connells or whatever, you know, Jangle Pop. No, I already know them. Tell me why I might like Oscar Wilde because of R.E.M. or Flannery O'Connor. That's interesting. And I think Netflix is really the worst offender of this. I mean, they're a bad offender. They're so bad at that. And it's not... They're, oh man! I mean, try to find a music documentary on Netflix, and clearly they don't care. You know they could do this better. Clearly, and this is the sad thing, and I hate to get cynical because I'm just not. But like, as I said earlier, like they've gone all in with Adam Sandler, you know, and that just bumps me out.
Well, yeah, but I feel like so. There's a couple things to unpack from everything you just said, and I think the first one is a lot of times people fail to realize that music is part of a broader lifestyle that people build around themselves. So, you know, if you're R.E.M., it's like this very Southern thing and Flannery O'Connor and, you know, certain drinks and certain, and, you know, you look at one thing. So there was that band, LMFAO.
Oh, yeah, sure,
and
yeah.
I can't believe I'm ever going to say this.
Do it.
LMFAO did some really smart stuff in that they built a lifestyle brand around themselves.
Sure.
It was the neon and the shutter shades and these dance parties in LA and weekend trips to Vegas and t-shirts and this and that. And, you know, Steve Aoki did actually a similar thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not my particular taste, but it's really smart in the sense that people... like the Spotify's of the world don't understand that music is part of this broader ecosystem that people are consuming.
Well, you're right. And you've crystallized something that I've been struggling with for so long. And that's, you know, that music is information, right? That's my line. And I say that all the time and it's sort of glib and it's used to explain why, whenever someone seems genuinely surprised that people won't pay for music, which I can't believe people are. But I just say, well, that's because when music went from analog to digital, it switched to information, and people share information, and people use information to contextualize other things, and therefore they share it. And so you really had it. It's almost like the blanket or the clothes or whatever that we wear to define things. I will say back to Steve Aoki or to LMFAO or whatever, what you're saying is this theory I've been working on, I'm writing about it on my personal blog because nobody reads my personal blog, so that I can sort of work thoughts out, and then eventually sometimes they find themselves other more visible places. But I have this theory that great products or services, or durable ones at least, are like the mirror that Harry Potter finds in the beginning of the Sorcerer's Stone, where he goes upstairs and he looks into this mirror and he sees his parents in the mirror, right? And that mirror is called the Mirror of Erised, which is desire spelled backwards. And so it reflects back at him the thing that he most desires. And great products or great service and great bands do that, right? So when I was a 17-year-old kid listening to REM and reading about Peter Buck, what it was really doing was reflecting back at me an image, you know, me looking for some sort of older paternal sort of brother figure that could make me feel cool about myself, right? And it went way beyond the music. It was a whole lifestyle. I needed that information. I needed to know what alcoholic beverage to drink. I needed to know what book I should read, because I wasn't getting that information from anyone else. And by looking at REM, they shone a mirror back at me that made me a more realized self. Well, we as humans, it's not, as you say, siloed. It's not just the music. That's just information that sort of extends outwards. There's all the other things in our life. And how does a product or a service do that effectively? I don't know. But the one that does, they're going to win, right?
Well, the interesting thing is, like, it's made shareable. So, you know.
Well, that's what information is. Information is shareable. You can share information without losing anything yourself when you share it. The person you share it with gains, and then you both gain, because now you can talk about something.
Right. And that's why this whole sort of idea of like artificial scarcity and keeping things in silos, especially like inside Spotify. And now there's this whole insanity about getting rid of freemium. And I'm just like, it's not going to work, because
it can't
especially
work.
Especially if you look at, I hate to say kids today, but kids today, you know, they share everything. And they want to define themselves based on what they're listening to, the line that I throw out there, which I can't believe no one's called me out on this before, is consumption on demand and without apology. And that's like a weird in-joke.
Say that again. Consumption on demand without apology. I like that.
Consumption on demand and without apology. Yeah, it's like a weird in-joke from the 90s. But
What's the reference?
It's actually a reference to...
You've already admitted to listen to LMFAO, so like
No, this is it's a reference to radical feminism from the 90s and Riot Girl, and they basically were saying abortion on demand and without apology in the 90s, so I changed it to consumption, which I think is a weird thing on a lot of levels, but it's also a commentary on millennials and how millennials are focused away from hard politics and onto consumption and sharing, but it's a whole other millennial critique that I can get into. But
I'd like to, I'd be vastly more interested to get into that critique than the current conversation, but that's okay. Invite me back.
We're going off the rails, but this is fun. The whole point is like, if you are making information not easy to share and collaborate around,
fail.
Yeah, it's a total fail. And I feel like that's, you know, it's like Spotify is almost the antithesis of music discovery. It's music discovery in a closed ecosystem.
It's not discovery. Like, I wish, like, we need to just like say that, like, right? That none of these services are offering discovery. Not their fault. People don't want to discover stuff. In the article, I talk about this thing called the reminiscence bump. We are both doing it. We are both going back and referencing the things that were significant to us when we were 18 years old, right? We can't help this, because biologically and genetically, our synapses and hormones and everything else are going crazy at this point. And the things that we are listening to make this deep ingrained impression that we never shake. And we, you know, so I, sad to say, will be making fucking REM references until I die, and you will be making Kurt Cobain references, and I will always and forever be seeking that music that made me feel the way, you know, Life's Rich Pageant did or whatever, and I'll never find it. And that's sort of okay. I will find other things that bring me delight for other reasons. I really like Haim. You know, there's other stuff that I find I listen to. You know what? It doesn't make me feel the way I did when I first heard Radio Free Europe. It can't. But that doesn't mean that there isn't this whole cosmology around those things that can continue to be super interesting and satisfying in things that I will pay to access that information for. Like, I would pay to hear you sort of throw shit at me that I might be interested in, you know? Not a lot, but I'd pay something. It's value. I pay more than I pay for Spotify, right? Because I want the nuance, right? I want the nuance, but it has to have some sort of sense. But it's funny that the reference that we're making just absolutely verify my whole thesis of, yeah, we keep going back to those things that we sort of like really hit us hard when we were like between the ages of 16 and 22.
So I definitely agree with this sentiment that I have a stronger connection to the music that I heard when I was younger than per se to the music that I hear nowadays. But I have found those bands that did connect with me at this new stage of life and have become the favorite band that supplanted all the other ones, right? Like, I discovered Frightened Rabbit probably 2 or 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And for me, like, that perfectly described what it's like to be in a relationship as an adult and those more mature and nuanced emotions that you experience inside of a relationship that just aren't the stuff that you would have caught onto when you're listening to Stained or any of the other kind of early 2000 rock bands that produced love ballads, right?
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that's sort of like the Richard Ford theory of music, right? Like that as an adult, you like become like you need to read Richard Ford's books or whatever, because he talks about divorce and things like that, that or John Updike or something that like you couldn't appreciate when I get that. Like, I don't want to read that shit. And the same reason, like, I'm an entrepreneur, so I can't watch Shark Tank or something. It's just way too, like, it just makes me jittery, you know, like I mean, it's cool that you found that and, or like, I hear people say that about like John Hyatt or something, like he talks about adult emotions or whatever. And I'm just, I guess I'm just too immature or something. Like, I don't want to hear John Hyatt singing about his divorce or his life as a middle-aged man. Like, that's just, oh gosh. But like, if that's serving your function, I'm with you. I mean, for me, like Sonic Youth, not their lyrics or anything, but just like the dissonance or so-called dissonance, like that sounds so harmonious to me now. And it didn't when I was 22. It sounded cool and weird and neat. And now it just sounds beautiful, you know? And I find that with certain jazz too. But it's interesting. Like, I got to check out Frightened. I think Daytrotter did something with them, so I sort of know their name. But is that what you're talking about? Like, that, so that now you've graduated to some sort of more adult form of entertainment? Like, I don't like that at all.
I wouldn't call it graduating. I'm not sure what I would call it. Like, I have my own theory about, like, what it's like to grow up listening to nu metal music that's mostly about being depressed and hating your parents.
Right.
And then growing up to be a civilized adult who doesn't hate their life and loves their parents and feels guilty about being 16.
Well, and there's also the idea that like that music can grow with you. So, I'll go back to the 90s again.
Yeah.
Because I've kind of stuck there today. So yeah. I listened to Exile in Guyville for the first time when I was like 13 years old.
Yeah.
Which I would not recommend.
I listened to it last summer and it's awesome.
Like, yeah.
It holds up. It's so durable. I love it. It's so durable.
And it grows with you. Like there are songs on there that I liked when I was 13, but
right.
You know, I'm almost 35 and
right.
Now I have like a husband and different adult relationships.
Right.
There's stuff. I'm finding stuff in that record every time I listen to it. I liked it when I was 13 because she sang about blowjobs, and I liked it at 34 because she sings about like intricate adult relationship issues. And yeah, there's also, but again, but you know, the Steve John Stevens
you're
record.
You're just describing great art, Courtney, right? I mean,
yeah.
like I got a theory that great art doesn't demand scrutiny, but it rewards it, right? So like you couldn't possibly give the scrutiny of a 35-year-old woman as a whatever 14-year-old girl when that record came out. You dug it, you couldn't understand it, but that I mean, say what you will, I just think that's a great record. I think that, yeah, that's durable. It will stand the test of time. I mean, for me, that's Monk, right? Like, I mean, I started listening, I studied jazz guitar when I was a kid, and I liked it, and I could sort of, but man, I listen to that stuff now, just in Coltrane in particular. I mean, that stuff just breaks my heart, you know, in so many different levels. And I think, and that's true of visual arts, true of films, it's true of all great art. It has a sort of durability to it, you know.
But then are we closing ourselves off? So like the other example I was going to give, yeah, is the new Sufjan Stevens record, which is incredible. And I played it for my father, who is, yeah, almost 70. Yeah. And my father had I won't go into it all, but he had a troubled relationship with his parents. And the Sufjan, yeah, record is all about the death of a parent, which is something he went through fairly recently. And he couldn't stop listening to that record, and he's 70 years old. And he was like, awesome, I discovered this new record that is hitting me in this incredibly emotional way, you know? And so that's the thing. It's like, I feel like part of the time, if we buy into this idea that we stop discovering stuff, we shut ourselves, yeah, off from the idea of like,
and that's the thing that I got really upset about. I mean, I totally understand how someone, you guys are both writers, you know, you have to have a point of view, or why bother writing, right? Like, I believe that the moment that there is some sort of absence of hope or possibility, that you get bitter, right? That, and so that was a business article. That was, I didn't frame it right. I mean, that was more, hey, look, businesses, you're sort of going about this wrong. You're super serving the wrong customers, right? From a human point of view, all I want is some moment of transcendence, you know, and for me, art gives me that. So all I want is that. So the idea that I can never find it except for to go back and listen to Chronic Town for the billionth time, that's very sad to me. And I don't believe that to be true. So I didn't want to, and I regret if I sort of gave the impression that, oh, no, we'll never find it. Yeah, of course, that's not true.
Let's go back and talk about the business side of it then, because I do think the business stuff, you're dead on where, you know, so Kyle and I were prepping for this call, and we were jokingly, Kyle was reading a list off of Product Hunt of all the music discovery apps that are out there right now. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, oh my God, like there's a million of them and they all do the same thing and no one, right, uses any of them and they're all sort of terrible.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, so here's the thing. If we're all correct, which I think we are, why is there a new music discovery app coming out literally every other week?
Well, because people are stupid. I mean, because there's so many open APIs out there that you can grab whatever and you can cobble something together. Look, I've been in the music space for a really long time. I don't understand why, you know, there's an allure to the music space on one hand that is almost unavoidable for people. Like, I don't know why that is. Unfortunately, the people for whom it is avoidable are the ones that we most need. There's such a low barrier of entry into music, and people feel that there's a massive market and a massive problem to be solved. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the people that are doing that don't really have the experience or the wherewithal to do something good, so they just clutter the space. The people that do have the wherewithal and the experience to do something good look at the music market and get scared, because of all the transactional elements. And by that, I mean things like the copyright laws and you know, I have a law degree, so I know these things really well. But, and I'm not saying they're necessarily bad, but they are hugely transactional. So if you've got, for instance, a bunch of investment money behind you and you want to enter the music space with some sort of quote unquote new or innovative idea, you're going to have a hard time shoehorning that idea into existing sort of frameworks as established by the copyright law or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or whatever. And so then you're faced with, okay, now I've got to go make deals with the labels or whatever. And so the smart money sort of stand on the sidelines. And that's a topic for a different podcast. But that's the biggest problem facing the industry. So then that leaves you with the people that aren't educated enough to even know what they're getting into. And so they throw some piece of shit app out there. And all it does is sort of cement the idea that that music is I don't know. But I think that's the problem. I mean, anybody can build a music app, quote unquote discovery app, by cobbling together various APIs, and then they're not good. They don't do anything. The customers don't like them. They stop using them, and it's just a very cluttered space. And then the good ones, I mean, you can say what you will, and I had conflicted opinions about Echo Nest until I met with their CEO recently, interviewed him, and I like him. He's a smart guy, and he said something to me, and I don't think that it's, I probably shouldn't say it, but let me put it this way. They have things that they're doing now that I think are interesting and could be innovative. The good or the bad of it is that Spotify owns them, you know, and so I don't know. Where's the next Echo Nest? Where's the next one that's going to be independent of them? And so that's a problem too, right? If your business model is, okay, we are going to curate the music business better than anyone else, and we're a third party, right? We're an independent, come up with an app, a business, or whatever, right? And then you go and you say, hey, Spotify, hey, Songza, hey, whoever, Beats, we have this service. You should use us. And Beats looks at it and goes, okay, yeah, this will work really well for us, right? So then you're the independent app. You go, okay, now we've got Beats signed on. Now we're also going to go to Tidal. Well, now all these, you see what I'm saying? And so now these services are all using the same sort of thing. And that's exactly what happened with Echo Nest. And they couldn't, and then you've got Spotify going, well, we can't really give you, Echo Nest, all of our proprietary information because you'll just use that to make your service better and then sell it to this other app. And you see the problem? And that's why, I don't think I'm articulating it well, but I actually am explaining to you why the music recommendation services suck. And it's a business reason.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I feel like, look, there are good music startups out there. Like Kyle and I both work for some. I've consulted for a bunch. Like, you know, this is not to say like every music startup.
Well, you should shout them out.
Yeah, no, every music startup is not abysmal.
No, it's, you should say, tell your listeners who they are. I want to know, who are they?
Oh, we do in the intro. But yeah, so I mean, like, we, you know, we're not saying like every startup in the music space is not abysmal. Like, there's some good ones out there. But I feel like the stuff that you're hitting at is there's a couple core problems, right? One of them is data. So the issue is, you know, the reason that we can't get good recommendations is because the data is just not there. Like, there's some machine inside Amazon that doesn't connect Kim Gordon with Sonic Youth.
Right.
Or there's some machine inside Apple that doesn't connect Americans, yeah, to Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
So, you know, that's a huge problem. And arguably, I think the biggest problem the music industry faces is the fact that, you know, we can't get stuff to people in a timely manner. So what we're in an interesting manner. So what we're left with is this sort of default idea of, you like REM, you might like The National. You like The Kitty Kill.
Exactly.
You might like Liz Phair. You like, you know, and sometimes like,
yeah, I'm familiar with The National. Thank you. You know?
Yeah. You know, and it's really this, we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago on Tidal where we interviewed some users, just people that aren't music people at all.
Yeah.
Just these girls that I actually know from my running club. And one girl said something so fascinating where Kyle basically said, you know, what do you want? And she said,
right,
I want to hit a play button and like everything that I hear.
Yeah, but okay, but so unpack that. I mean, so that's AC radio, right? I mean, I'm not saying this girl would like AC radio, but the whole gambit of AC radio is to keep their playlists are so narrow, so they don't want you to ever change the channel. So what that girl is really saying, if you, is that it's not, the only thing she's really going to like is the stuff she knows. You know, I mean, there is a chance that she'll be distracted long enough when something new comes on so as to not change the whatever, and then hear it long enough to go, wow, that's actually pretty cool. That does happen. I'm not saying that never happens, but dominantly what she's saying is, play me the stuff I already know, right?
Potentially, or play me the stuff that I know I'm going to like.
I don't agree.
I would say my interpretation was this. What she was looking for is the easy button.
But the easy means give me me what I know. That's what all customers go across any business, guys. I mean, I'm not making some bold statement. If you look at any business, any service, when you introduce something new, the customers don't initially like it. If you can keep their attention long enough, some of them, for whatever way you do that, some of them will grow to like it and go, oh, you know what? At first I didn't like this, but now I really did. But the default disposition for 99.9% of customers is give me what I already know. For anything, for Campbell's soup. You know, it's not just music that's like this.
So I would be curious. I mean, you worked on and worked at Daytrotter for a number of years. How did Daytrotter approach music discovery and curation in the service?
There is that small number of people, and small percentage-wise, doesn't mean that compared to the total market, doesn't mean it's a small number in an absolute sense, who, like the three of us on this call, actually want someone whose taste that they respect and admire to tell them what they should listen to next. Sean Mueller is that guy for some people. Some people really think that based on Sean's track record for doing this for however long, that when they go to Daytrotter, they will hear some band that they never heard before, and that they will like it. This is not new to me. This was exactly what we did with Rykodisc. Rykodisc, the sort of mantra that we had was, we're music fanatics making music for other music fanatics. That's a very, very different type of mantra than, you know, Interscope Records or Universal Records, where it's like, no, we're going to make music for the people that buy two records a year, right? And you know, because if we can get that, we'll sell 20 billion records or whatever. We were going after both. I mean, this appears to be my life, for better or worse. You know, same with Daytrotter, same with Contravolt, and to a certain extent, same with TuneCore, same with all the companies that I've been involved with. You know, going after those people that are at that sort of far edge of the distribution curve and super serving them. You know, and for some people that works, and for some people it's like, you know, I don't want this band I've never heard of. But there is a group of people that are out there that do it. The problem for the bigger music services is that doesn't scale very well, right? They're stuck in the space of, you know, we need to get millions and millions and millions and millions of subscribers. Well, at that point, now you've gone way beyond early adopter land into sort of majority land. And once you get into majority land, then you find yourself square in hot AC world again. It's like, well, let's give them John Mayer and the Police, and you know what I mean? So it's sort of an axiomatic problem. And that's why I say that I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we all wish we had the crystal ball to see where sort of the Spotify thing goes. Where we know the music won't go, music business won't go, is we will never return to a place where people are going to be paying for recorded music again. It can't ever happen. So,
and yet, so many people think it will.
But how could it? I mean, it's just not logical.
No, I don't know, but like every executive is out there banging the drum to get rid of freemium, and I'm like,
Lucian Grange is saying that he's going to do that, and now you've got Apple, who's apparently lobbying whomever, and maybe this is what Jay-Z was talking about with the Illuminati, to say that, you know, that Spotify's got to do away with their free tier. See, the problem with that theory is there's an elasticity there, where if you put these artificial, if you go on the assumption that music is information, which it is, and you put these artificial barriers up, there is a moment of elasticity where people go, you know, I'll pay five, I'll pay nine, you know, I won't pay 12, I won't pay 15, but I'm not going to stop getting my music for free, so I'm going to go steal it. I mean, that's the problem. It you know, that is always an alternative that's never going to go away. I mean, if you really think that you know, and I'm not saying these people are stupid. They may go, okay, yeah, that's we accept that. We accept that a vast majority of our market that now is paying a little bit or is generating some money from ad services is going to go to piracy. We're going to make our money off of those people that are at a time in their life where they're just. It's not going to go to whatever the pirate site is, and we're going to keep trying to shut down whatever the next version of Pirate Bay is. It's a slow, painful death, you know.
Well, but the problem is, so for people in our age group, like I have Spotify, I pay for Spotify. I don't love it, but it's good enough for me to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm happy to, because I went to college I was in college when Napster happened, but I never quite got to the point where I was just downloading everything for free and getting everything for free. Like, I still have it ingrained in me to like pay something for music, even if it's just for Plus Spotify.
It's not your values either, right? I mean,
yeah. But then you look at everyone who's younger than me, who grew up, not even with Napster, with YouTube, with Pandora, with just the ability to easily share free music wherever. Because
it's information. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't convince them that it's not.
So then you just put a timeline on your business. You're like, okay, fine. Everyone, we're all going to die. This generation, we're all going to get old and die at some point. And the next generation and all subsequent generations.
Yeah.
So you're kind of just like, okay, we bought the music business as it stands, what, 10 more years, 15 more years? Good.
I think the music business is gone. I think
Label business.
Right. The institutional music business. I mean, I can't even express how irrelevant that is. But there's certainly a business in which music is a big component. And I'm actually wildly optimistic because once you do start recalibrating it around the idea, and you hit it at the beginning of this talk, where music is more information, where music is more part of your life in a nuanced way that connects you to other things, there's a deep and profound value proposition there. But we get so hung up on our sort of entrenched and they're entrenched because a lot of these executives are making an awful lot of money based on doing what it is that they've done through their career. So they have no rational reason to change that behavior, right? They're just going to entrench. And until that does start to change, we're going to, as you say, have this sort of slow death. And the drag is, and this is what I meant earlier, the reason that that's not changing faster is because of the complicated and sort of somewhat obstructionist laws predicated by, the labels and publishers sort of putting a line item out in their budgets for litigation. I mean, that's really how a lot of them are making their money now. They're just trolling the internet looking for infringements and suing off of them. So that's, that'll secure your job, just as you say, for some period of time, but it's really not a good long-term business model.
Well, and it's funny to me who becomes a hero and a villain in this case, because, we hated, quote unquote, big major labels for so long. And now there's almost like a sympathetic take on them. Like, oh, look at Spotify taking all their music. And, I think about this with Uber,
the taxi and limousine commission
is seen sympathetically.
But hold on. And you bring up two important points. I mean, first off, the labels are equity holders in Spotify.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, so when Spotify does whatever it does, I can't imagine it IPOs, but maybe it does, or maybe whoever buys them, the labels will go great. Or if Spotify needs to keep taking cash, the labels will eventually convert debt to equity, and then it'll be theirs, So maybe that's how it, like when Sony shut down whatever idiotic music service they had and said, we're going all in on Spotify, that was a distinction without a difference. They just, and then with Uber's really interesting. Like, you can position the labels, the analog being that the labels are like the taxi service or whatever, and Uber was the sort of disruptor. And I think it's a good comparison because Uber had to fight through similar bureaucracies and legal wranglings that anyone that wants to sort of disrupt the institutional label system has to. The difference again is, you can say, okay, no, I'd rather not take this cab. I'll pay more for Uber. It breaks down because with music, you can go, okay, yeah, I could do this, I could do this, or I can just take it for free. And there isn't that free option with this sort of taxi comparison.
Well, carjacking.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you're right, I guess, but typically carjackers are prosecuted a little bit more strenuously than somebody that downloads the Taylor Swift record. But yeah, you're right, carjacking.
Well, George, it's been really nice talking to you on the show today. If people want to look you up online and learn more about your services or the companies that you're involved with, where can they find that?
Twitter's good. I mean, GAH650 is my little Twitter handle. I'm pretty easily findable there. And then I have a blog called 9, and then giantsteps.com. But anybody wants to find me, I'm not hard to find out there on the internet world.
And what about Music Audience Exchange?
Yeah, I'm very excited about this company. This we are trying to do sort of what Jeff Price dominantly and me to a certain extent did with access to markets with TuneCore when we started. TuneCore Music Audience Exchange is doing a similar thing with radio as well as brand access. There's you know, as we all know, I mean, payola is a big, it's a reality, and so that makes it challenging for artists to get their music played on the radio. And then on the branding side, I mean, brands have sort of become the new radio in some respects for artists. In other words, brands using music. The problem is it's not done. It's still done too much on sort of instinct and feel and all that, and that won't last, right? So we're trying to create a system that's actually will be better for not only the brands but certainly for the artists and also for the people that listen to the ads, and to try to use some logic and some business principles and apply that to something that for too long it's been really ad hoc. And not that I mind the ad hoc thing, it's just that doesn't last, right? We have this weird little honeymoon period now where people that are my age and younger are the kids that grew up on sort of indie rock. And it's why you hear, again, going back to our main topic, you hear all these, I mean, how many times has Pixies songs been used in movies and ad campaigns of late, right? I mean, I just heard a string quartet version of some Pixies song in some ad the other day, right? And that's because they're all people our age that had that reminiscence bump, that sort of magical effect in time when we were kids listening to the Pixies, and now they have jobs as a music supervisor or whatever. Well, who are they going to pick? So we're trying to sort of put some science around that and provide access both to bands and brands to these markets. So it's what I mean about interesting and innovative things. And I give Nathan Hanks, you know, the co-founder on this, all the credit. He came from a company called Reach Local, which did really sort of innovative and amazing things with sort of local marketing and SEO and Google Analytics, and brought that public. And so he's taken some of that big brain to music, and I'm happy to be able to help.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, anytime. You know, I mean, I can't imagine you will invite me back, but should you have the impulse, I'd love to do it. You know, whenever I can be of assistance.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this show out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.